be here. And this week's speaker is Jerry. Can you please help me welcome Jerry?
I'm Jerry. I'm an alcoholic. Sobriety date, April 23rd, 1975. And I never say that in a bragging way because it's my higher power, I choose to call God. And a lot of meetings. Somebody said at one of the meetings the other day, they said, how come you've been able to stay sober so long? He said he went to one too many AA meetings. Takes a while to sink in. I'm going to try desperately to stick the way I was taught to give a talk. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And try to stay away from the drunkalogs. Some of them you can't get away from because they're part of your story. I did not do drugs, so I won't bring that up. But I did shoot a pretty good stick with the Jack Daniels, okay? I was born in Cincinnati, Ohio, April 1st, 1935. And the birthday should have told me something right away that I was in for trouble. April Fool's Day. came from a, I would say what I now understand to be a dysfunctional family, although I love my dad a lot. He was an alcoholic, and it was a nightmare when he'd get juiced up. And that was what I had to put up with when I was a kid. My brother was in the war, World War II, and he was gone for about 5 years. So as I was growing up, I had a real heavy load with dad being drunk because I loved him so much. You know how we all love drunks, right? Not too much going on, except the turn in my life came when I found a drumstick, that's a drumstick, in the gutter. And I picked it up, and I took, it was just one, and I went home and I started beating on stuff with it. And I was sitting in a rocking chair, and I'd sit there and listen to the music and get the feel of the music. And little by slowly, I got a full set of sticks, and next thing I did, I got a little set of drums. And very, very early on, at age 16, I was probably the youngest member of the union playing in a strip joint in Cincinnati. And I backed up a lovely lady called Egyptian Ella. And she, her song was, if I can't sell it, I'm going to sit right down on it and I ain't going to give it away. That was her theme song. And she's about 300 pounds, you know. So at 16, I really had a lot to learn. And I was really wet behind the ears, even though I, you know, I should have known better, but. So from that, I watched too many John Wayne movies, saw Sands of Iwo Jima and a few other Semper Fi movies, and joined the Marine Corps. I had absolutely no idea what I was doing, except my buddy came back from boot camp and said, hey, they got a heck of a program. You ought to get in on it. I'll take you down and introduce you to the sergeant. And next thing I knew, I was in the Marine Corps. And I had about as much reason for being in the Marine Corps as a man in mood. I weighed 135 pounds. I was 6'2". And the Navy guy came over and he says, I don't think you ought to join the Marines. Come on over and get 4 years with the Navy. You'll be a lot better. I said, no, I'm going to be a Marine. By God, you know, I'm going to be a Marine. So, oh, my God. Anyway, I went to, I don't know how I got to boot camp. I was the whipping boy in boot camp because I was a real snot-nosed, what they call drugstore cowboy. I had all the smart answers. The drill instructors just love to get a hold of somebody like that. Right, Jack? Yeah. They used to ask, anybody here go to college? And people raise their hands. It's good. Now we'll all stand around and watch him pick up paper. Maybe we can learn something, you know. Well, my Marine Corps history up to that time, after I got out of boot camp, we all went to a nice, cozy little town called Tijuana, Mexico. And there's a long bar down there. It's 1 mile long. Anybody ever been to Tijuana, Mexico? You have. There's a bar down there, and I don't know if it's still there or not, but the contest was see if you could drink from one end to the end, to the end of the bar. And, you know, I hadn't had that much experience drinking, so I was pretty soused quickly. And we had rented a Jeep in Oceanside, California, where the Marine base is, Camp Pendleton. Coming back, as far as I can remember, on 395, we got hit by a cab driver. And we got knocked into, I got knocked into a 20-foot gully, and my head was, my neck was like this. And Pete DiClemente, God bless him, he's a wrestler and a real tough little guy. He heard me moaning in the back of the thing, and I said, my neck, I said, don't worry about that, I'll take care of that. And he's got a hold of my head doing this. And I got a broken neck, Charlie. I get into the sick bay, and the doctor goes like this. He says, get on the gurney. He took the x-ray. He says, you broke your neck in two places. He says, you're in for a long recuperation. And I was. It was almost 6 months in traction, and they had stuff in my, they call it a halo now. And I had all this kind of stuff on and a body cast and everything else. They had just enough room for my stomach and a mouth so I could sip some soup and little ear holes. It was really very torturous. Well, the day came when they took the cast off. They put me in a neck brace. And I looked at myself and I said to the doctor, I said, "You guys put my neck on wrong." He says, "What?" I said, "Well, look at it. It's got a curve in it, you know." "No, no." He says, "No, it'll come back. Don't worry about it." And he must have reported it to whoever was in charge of my discharging. They said, "You know, we have a great solution for you." He says, "You're going to become what we call a psychological cripple. Did you think about that?" He said, "We have a little place called the Land of the Morning Calm." That was Korea. And they sent me to the Land of the Morning Calm to recuperate. So I got into Korea, and not too many war stories, and if I did have any, I probably wouldn't tell you about them anyway. All I know is about 4 months before the ceasefire, we never did settle a peace agreement with the Gooks, pardon me, Koreans. I know it's politically incorrect to call them Gooks, loof to Gook. But anyway, we signed a ceasefire, and I was there about 4 or 5 months before that ceasefire. And we drank a lot because we weren't supposed to drink the water. The Korean farmers had a very unique way of fertilizing their fields. And I can see from nod ahead, you know what I'm talking about. So if you drink, they did make cauliflowers this big, though. They were beautiful. You know? So we got a beer ration. The army, officers got a rum ration. They got liquor. So I wanted to get something better. So I traded a Sten gum with a British, we were attached to the United Nations and attached to the 8th Army, et cetera, et cetera. And I traded a Sten gum for a fifth of, I think it was VO. That was my first blush with hard liquor. And I drank a lot of that and got very sick. In fact, I'm lucky to even be standing here that I didn't get 20 years in Mare Island, if you know where Mare Island is. It's a naval prison. Because my outfit moved out, and I was passed out underneath a cot in a tent. Thank God for the Navy. I have nothing against the Navy. Because the corpsman took up, he says, "Oh," he says, "David's dead." "No, that's okay. He's all right." He says, "He's on medication. He had a broken neck at Camp Pendleton, and then he was sent over here." He gave this officer in charge, the officer of the day, a bunch of baloney. He said, "All right, well, get him out of here. His outfit's up the street." I could have been court-martialed for that. But thank God I wasn't, and I got up to the front, and as I said, eventually the ceasefire was ended, and I came back to the States, and I didn't know what the heck to do. I was 20 years old, 19 years old, and I didn't have any idea what I was going to do. I started playing in bands again a little bit, playing some night gigs and a few weekend gigs, and a buddy of mine gave me a job, and I didn't have much high school credits. I think I had one credit in band and one credit in some other crazy thing. It was horrible background. And he says he knew some of the Jebbies at Xavier University, and he says, "Why don't we give him a chance to see what he can do?" So they put me on probation. I went to college. I did real well for the first two semesters, and then I just started drinking real heavy in college. And I was playing in bands in college. And I met a gal, and eventually we got married. We had 6 children. And I have to back up just a little bit because when I got out of the service, I said to you, I didn't know what I was going to do or what my life was going to take. I got a hold of a pretty famous author. I'm sure at least one of them, you know, who Thomas Merton was. And I read his 7-Story Mountain. And I said, "That's for me. I want to go to Bardstown, Kentucky and be a Trappist monk." So I went to the Jesuit advisor. He knew I had just been a Catholic, I've converted and only been a Catholic about a year. He looked one, he says, "You are not timber for the Bardstown Monk Society." I said, "Why not?" He says, "Because you're not grounded." And he was right. I was a zealot. I was going around the dorms telling guys it shouldn't be drinking and it shouldn't be doing foolish things on the, you know, and they come in late at 2:00 in the morning, "Where were you?" And I said, "Go to that cross and tell them you're sorry." And I was a Catholic for 1 year. Come on, you know. Father Dietz did me a favor and didn't let me go to, you know. So I did the next best thing a Catholic does at the time, prior to Vatican II. I got married and had 6 kids real fast, you know. Anyway, God bless them. They're still around. My poor wife is still around, my ex-wife. Then from the little jobs that I got in the band business, I started playing in some really good groups, really, really good groups. And some group came into town. We were playing at a club over in northern Kentucky called the Lookout House. And it was the String Brothers. At the time, the lead singer was as famous as Julio Iglesias is, or was, about 10 years ago. And it was quite a group. And they said, "Gringo, you want to play the drums for me?" And I said, "Yeah." Well, so we'll come to New York and play. So we'll give you a call. Here's a phone number. You can just change phone numbers. So they called me, and 2 weeks later, I opened up in Kiamisha Lake, up the Concord. Anybody know where New York is? Or, I mean, you know where New York is. I didn't know where New York was at the time, still young. Anyway, we worked the Borscht Belt, or the Jewish Himalayas, as it's affectionately termed. And that night, we opened. We had over 1,000 people in the main ballroom where everybody sat there and listened. And I got to fraternize with some pretty nice people. My big claim to fame is Rodney Dangerfield and I shared a dressing room together. And he said, "Can't you do something with your leader?" I said, "What's the matter?" He says, "I'm trying to do my comedy shtick, and he's in the wings warming his voice up, Hector, doing me, 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 me." And Rodney's out there trying to do his routine, you know. I said, "Rodney, I have no control over Hector at all. He is a jerk of the first order," which eventually got me fired, by the way. We did not get along at all. I lasted less than 3 months up there. Came back to Cincinnati. I didn't know what in the world to do then. And by that time, because of my, you know, wanderings and drinking and everything in the band business, I think we got one more. I got one more really good job in a place called the Gifts and Girl Lounge in Cincinnati, Ohio. And does anybody know where that is? Okay. It was the premier spot, nightclub to play in. And there was a lot of drinking and a lot of groupies that used to hang around. We had the patrons name our group. The group was called the Saloonatics. And we were definitely that. Anybody know what a Mickey Finn band is? Mickey Finn's out in California. People come from all over the place. If there's shows in town, Broadway shows, when the place closes, they all come in and jam with you. So all these people are in there and there's audience participation. Everybody sings. It is one heck of a great place for a drunk. Everybody wants to buy you drinks. We would take a break and go across the street and buy drinks. And I've had a tom-tom. I never did hit it with a stick because it was a cocktail table. It's about like this. And he'd loaded with your back. "Buy the drummer a drink." There's drinks all over the place. And yet we go across the street, typical alcoholic, and buy more drinks. And then at 1 o'clock, we would go across the river to good old Newport, Kentucky. Anybody know where Newport, Kentucky is? Stan Schrotel, who was the chief of police of Cincinnati, Ohio, got a great commendation. He was featured in Life magazine as police chief of the year. And the reason he was so good was he sent all the criminals over to Newport, Kentucky. He says, "You guys just go on over there." There was gambling and anything you wanted, you could get Newport or Covington, Kentucky. And I met up with some people that knew some people, you know what I mean? And one night down in Fort Lauderdale, I was speaking, and I mentioned a guy named Sleepout Louie Levinson, and after the meeting, and Screen Door Harry. And this guy comes up to me, and they had told me about, I won't mention his name, he says, "Do you know who that is?" I said, "No." He says, "He used to go into the Eden Rock in Miami, and people would go absolute ballistic, because he was an enforcer for the mafia. And he became one of us." He came up to me after the meeting, he says, "That's Screen Door Harry and Sleepout Louie Levinson. I knew them both." I said, "Really? Great. Thank you." You know, but he was a great guy. Everybody looked up to him, but of course, nobody wanted to cross his path with his background and his resume. You know. So let's see. After the Gifts and Girl Lounge, which I also lost that job because one night we all wore tuxedos. We had quite a group, and I had been drinking all day, and I missed the call. And I came down at 1:30 in the morning, the place was all closed up, and I'm standing there, and the bellhop goes, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm going to work." He said, "Man, you are out of it." He says, "It's 1:30 in the morning. They've been gone forever." I said, "Well, I got in trouble. I got a call at 2 in the morning. He said, we don't need you anymore." So that was the end of that. So I'm still on what it was like. What am I supposed to do? 40 minutes, I heard? How long did you tell us to do? 40 minutes? Okay, well, I'll try to skip it. Okay, that's fair enough. So after the fiasco with the Gibson girl, I decided to go into, I went into the used car business. Man, you talk about a lot of craziness. Well, I met a guy, I sold a guy at Thunderbird, and he was a pretty sharp guy. He had a diamond ring on his pinky, you know, he really dressed real nice. And I said, what's your name? And he says, Henry Hilton. I said, Henry Hilton? Oh, you know. So I went and told my boss, I says, I got Henry Hilton out here. Ooh, you know. So I said, what do you do for a living? And he says, I'm a management consultant. He says, I save companies millions of dollars, and I put part of it in my pocket, and it's legal. And I'm real cocky. I said, I'll go to work for you for $500 a week. And he just looked at me and said, send me a resume. He says, here's my card. So I prepared one. I said, dear Mr. Hilton, I have no idea what you do, but maybe we can mutually work out something that would be agreeable to both of us. Give me a call. The secretary called me. He says, he's never had a resume like that before. He says, he wants to talk to you. So we had about 3 interviews, and my wife at the time, may she rest in peace, Sandy, she was a heavy drinker, I was a drinker, and Henry and his wife were Henry drinkers, and Henry wanted to see how much we could hold our liquor. So my interview for 3 days, it consisted of drinking as much as we could drink without getting totally falling down drunk, which was kind of hard to do. Well, after that little test I passed, I got the job, and he says, now you're going to be Henry Hilton. I said, what? He says, this is so finite and so precision, you can't be, you're going to make calls for me as Henry Hilton. I'll do the calls, I'll make the sales, but you are Henry Hilton. So here's the Dun & Bradstreet, look up these corporations and call them. And I would call them up as Henry Hilton and make an appointment for Henry to go out, and he would make the sale, and I would get very little salary because I was really in training. Well, Mr. Cassidy, who ran the company up in Ridgefield, Connecticut, said, I get a little nervous, he says, when you guys start building a little empire down here in Cincinnati. He says, if this kid is as good as you say he is on the phone, he send him to Cleveland, Ohio, and he can have that territory. And if he makes 3 what they call jobs, 3 consulting jobs, we'll make him vice president of the company. Now, that's no big deal because everybody that had 3 jobs with vice president of the company because it looked good on your business card, you know. So I went up to Cleveland with a wife and a stepchild and a new baby and went out on 17,700 Broadway in Cleveland, which 2 weeks after we left there, the whole place burned down. I don't know what that had to do with it. But I'm sitting there in a small little room talking to chairman of the boards of the major corporations at Dun & Bradstreet, getting appointments for me. And then I went out, and I don't know what I did right. In fact, one of the big cheeses came into town and says, you must be living right. I said, why? He says, how many calls did you make before you got this sale? I said, 3. He says, you got Diamond Shamrock Oil Corporation in 3 interviews. The job turned out to be the biggest fee that they'd ever had in a company. It was over $1 million just to come in and do a work for them. And my cut was 12.5% of that. Well, I was actively drinking, and you know what a drunk will do with a lot of money. And I went out, and I went absolutely crazy because I had I would need a cosigner for cash. I had terrible credit, but I had a lot of money coming in. And my wife, bless her heart, she wanted a car, so I went in town and I bought a car. I said, how about if I give you half down? Oh, yeah, half down's fine. They didn't even bother about the credit. They just, you see, yeah, that's cool. And they gave me a payment book, and I made the thing. Then I got another job and another job. By that time, everybody that was an engineer, we had engineers do these jobs to make the implementations. Everybody that was anybody was in town at my house staying, and Cassidy about blew a gasket. He thought for sure I was building an empire up there. Well, I wasn't, and we convinced him that I was just doing my job and making a lot of money. Well, when the money came in so fast and furious, my little stepdaughter wanted a horse. I said, oh, okay, she wants a horse. Well, we'll get her a horse. So we found a little stable down in Akron. I went in, and Turnpike was out there, and we got this horse, brought it back for grazing and everything. And I said to the farmer, I said, what about that horse over there? Oh, you don't want that horse. I said, why? She says, well, what's her name? He says, her name is Dinah. I said, that's an unusual name for a horse. He said, well, she has a flatula. And I said, well, I don't care, whatever that is. I thought it was a musical instrument. What do I know? So they used to go on trail rides, but they made me stay all the way at the end of the trail because Dinah would blow her horn, you know. And if you were in the front, they wouldn't want to ride with you, you know. Well, that was another opportunity to do a lot of drinking. We all drank. We rode horses. We did all kinds of crazy stuff. Well, the boss up in Connecticut got a hold of me one day, and he says, you know, he says, your money's going to run out. You need to get some new jobs. Yeah, I know. I mean, I'm not telling you, money was rolling in. I had a little pigeonhole in Hudson, Ohio. Hudson, Ohio, they used to call it Peyton Place with Dutch Elms disease. It was a real swinging town. Anyway, there was a little thing, and there was checks in there made out to me, all this money from the stuff. Couldn't spend it fast enough. You know, bought another car because I didn't like the color of the other car I had just bought. I left that sit in the snow. It was a brand new Mercury Marquis, but I didn't like the green color. So I went out and got a Chrysler Imperial. And, I mean, just stupid, stupid stuff. Well, the whole thing came crashing down. IRS padlocked the house. We got chased out of town. God, it was a horrible mess. Well, I heard about the land boom in Atlanta, Georgia. They were selling raw land, and I thought, well, that's cool. So I went down and hooked up with a land boom company. And that was pretty edgy because you would, you know, start a rumor that, well, you know this place here? We're going to put a toddle house there, so you better get on this real quick. So we were selling stock to a would-be toddle house that wasn't going to be there anyway, you know. But in a farm town, it would go, they're going to bring a toddle house. You better get on some of that stock. So we had one guy that if we ran out of gas, he would always buy our stock, and we'd always make the last stop there. Because how much do I have to buy this time? I don't know, a couple of thousand. And that's how we got money to get gas to get out of town because I hadn't been able to sell anything that week when I was there. It was a crazy business. I'm almost at the point with what happened because I was so completely out of control. I was behind in support payments. The IRS got the house. I don't even know what happened to Dinah and Turnpike. I guess they took them for feed. I don't know what happened, you know. And I owed a lot of money, a whole lot of money. Even though I made all that money, I would just keep charging things and charging because that eventually I did get a good credit rating and then I destroyed it. So I got in the land business down there and that went belly up. And then another guy came along selling vacation packages to Florida and some housing in Florida. So we're on the phone at night selling housing in Florida, a place called Deltona, which I'm sure is still here somewhere around. It was a Mapple Brothers. Boy, I'm hot. Anyway, not hot because I'm just hot, hot. What did I do with my water? Thank you. The guy that I worked for was a real jerk, and I made a mistake of signing a note with him, and I made the mistake of putting up everything we owned. Everything, pictures, jewelry, furniture, whatever we had in this apartment in Sandy Springs. And, of course, we couldn't make the commitment. And I was out looking for work and doing stuff. By that time, my wife and I at the time had separated. And I found out one day that he showed up with a truck and took everything we had. And also found out later on through one of the people that I knew that he also put a heavy move on my wife. He said, if you stay here, I'll take care of you and you keep the furniture. And I didn't know anything about it. And I made a mistake one time of telling a buddy of mine that was hooked up, if you know what I mean. He was with some of the boys in Atlanta, and he heard me saying that this guy was taking everything we had. The one night he called me on the phone, and he says, what's that guy's name that's going to take all your stuff? And I said, why? He says, don't worry about it. What's his name? We'll take care of it. He says, well, he won't ever ask you for your furniture. He won't ever take your furniture again. I said, whoa, wait a minute. I don't want any part of this. I figured he was going to send some of the boys over. And once you do that, you know, then you owe them a favor. You know, like they want to borrow your trunk sometime in your car for a couple hours. Scary. So there I was, out of work. I went to work for a mobile home repossession company. And what we did there, that was a lot of fun. Try to take somebody who hadn't got any money anyway, take their home away from them. So we would bring them into this lot in Marietta. They don't say Marietta in Atlanta. They don't say Marietta. It's Marietta. And we put them in this big lot, and what we would do was we would take the toilet bowl out of this one and the refrigerator out of that one and a thing to make one that we could sell. Because, you know, it was piecemeal. Somebody's shaking their head. They know what I'm talking about. But this was a strange job. And I lived in one of these boxes, you know, and that's how far down I came, you know, and it was a mess. I'm trying to say, I wrote her name down. I thought I would never forget her name. God bless her. Her name was Brenda and Barry. Brenda and Barry were friends of mine, and Barry was working at Orlando Disney World as a plumber, and he left Jonesboro, Georgia, and left his girl, his, isn't that terrible? See what happens when you get old? I can't remember how her name was. Brenda. Brenda called me one day. We've been real friends, and her husband, or her fiance and I were friends. There was no hanky-panky. She said, listen, Barry's down here, and I'm sitting here doing nothing. You like flea markets? I said, yeah, I love them. She said, well, maybe at the flea market out on the highway, and we'll spend it Saturday together and go around, look at the stuff, and whatever, have fun. I said, yeah, that's cool. So we did, and she said, by the way, she said, I am a school teacher, and she says, I am the proctor or whatever you were, the chaperone for the senior class dance, and I need a male escort. Would you agree to do that? I said, well, sure, I'd love to. She said, good. She says, well, telling you what, Sunday there's an art show out here. She said, I like, you want to meet and go to the art show? I said, yeah, that's great. What do you hear from Barry? Oh, he's doing fine, blah, blah, blah. Everything was cool. So I met her on Sunday, and as being a drunk, I'd had a couple of shooters before I met her. And I wasn't with her 10 minutes. And she says, Jerry? I said, yeah. She says, you know that dance thing I asked you to do? I said, yeah. She says, forget about it. I said, what happened? Is it canceled? No. But she said, I got to tell you. She says, it's a personal insult to me that somebody has to have a couple of drinks before 11 o'clock in the morning to go out and work around the art show with me. And it also hurts me terribly to see somebody I care about ruin their life with alcohol. Now, everybody had tried to get me to stop drinking. Brenda came along at just the right time. And 2 days later, I was in AA. So I owe a lot to Brenda and Barry. What happened after that? I got in the back seat of a cab. I'd been drinking in a place called Bruiser's Pub. It's a nice place. We used to joke, it wasn't so rough a place that if you didn't have a gun when you went in there, they'd give you one. I was passed out in the walkway where the barmaids have to go through to get their drinks, and the owner, big sucker, man, he was a big dude. He says, who is that? She says, well, that's still the dignity, right? Still the dress suit and everything. Well, that's Mr. Davis. You better tell him he drinks like that. He better stay here and drink. He says, don't let him go anywhere else. He says, he can't do that. So the place closed. The next thing I know, this big dude has hoisted me up on his shoulder, and he's taken me down to the Tudor Inn, down on 285, 275, down Roswell Road, or whatever. And I hear him vaguely in my drunken stupor tell the guy, strictly right out of the New Testament, give him a room for the night. If there's any other expenses, put him on my tab, and I'll pay you when I come back. The next thing I know is about 10:30 or so in the morning, I wake up and I am a mess. I walk up the hill a little bit where Bruiser's Pub were, and Linda, the barmaid, was getting ready to open up. And I walked in, it was about 25 to 11, I ordered a beer. I drank about half of it, and I said to Linda, I said, dear me, I said, Lord, I need some help. I said, call me a cab, I got to get out of here, because I had a little room out on the Mayretta Highway in a little beat up motel, Crestfallen Manor. The cab driver came, and I was in the back seat, and as best I can remember, I put my hands on my head and I said, dear God, I need help. And then I said, I've got to call AA, because my dad had been in AA. And no offense to anybody that has, you know, that accent, but it's part of the story. The cab driver looked back at me and says, ha! My name is Lemar, and I ain't been to one of them meetings in 6 months, but these two guys that helped you. And he gave me two guys' phone numbers in an AA clubhouse in DeKalb County. And I called them from my room, and they said, can you stay off booze till noon till we can get you to a meeting? I said, yeah. So they came and they took me to a meeting. I'll never forget my first meeting. Never, as long as I live, I'll ever forget it, because every group has a Maggie. Maggie had 983 and a half years of sobriety. She was at least 75 or 80, and they had her do the chips. And she was a tough broad. She picked up the chips, she says, under every dress is a slip. She's talking about 13 stepping. That was my introduction to the chip system. Under every dress is a slip. And then she'd give out the chips as a warning, because she was, I'm sure, you know, sponsoring people, and some of these lecherous old men were trying to, why, you can read between the lines. Well, you know, I got to the meeting, and then when the meeting was over, they said, can you stay off liquor for another 4 or 5 hours? I said, yeah. They said, well, we'll bring Bob by, and Bob will pick you up for the meeting in a room similar to this. It was about this size. It was in Marietta. It was called the Rebus Club, which is sober spelled backwards. You know that from we have a Rebus Club here. So they came and picked me up, and all I remember is, I can remember the biggest word that I'll ever remember in AA was sit down, flaky, and shut up. My sponsor was from Boston, Pat Brady, and I was from Cincinnati, and every one of those people were good old Southern Rebel boys. And my sponsor used to say, Jerry, he said, the jury is still out on both of us, so just be cool. Man, I'll tell you, I really got worked over good. They would say things like, hey, Flaky, what are you doing Saturday? I said, well, I think, no, that's your big mistake. You don't think. You come down to the clubhouse, you're going to rearrange the pictures. I said, rearrange the pictures? He said, yeah. In other words, you're going to find something to keep you busy. You're going to do something. And by the way, we got a phone in the corner there. It's hooked into the relay. He said, you're going to answer that phone for 12-step calls. And then we'll write them down on the paper, and then after the meeting's over, we'll go out and we'll call them. What we call a 12-step call. And by the way, coffee has to be made. You get here, when you make the coffee, and after the meeting over, you need to empty the, when they still have smoking, you need to empty the ashtrays and on and on and on. And tomorrow morning is an eating meeting with, you know, and you'll be here to. So when we finished all that, then everybody went out to the Roach Coach, which was the ranch house. We all sat there, ate apple pie, ice cream, and drank tons of coffee. Never one of us ever said, boy, all this coffee going to keep me awake. It didn't bother us. Everybody in the place thought we were drunk because we're about 15 of us having so much fun. And you know how it is when we get out with us crazy people. We're just having a ball. And I'll tell you how much they don't leave you, didn't leave me alone. It's midnight at night, and there's a knock on the door, and there's two people standing there wanting to know how I'm doing. I said, I just got out of the meeting. I'm doing fine. What? They were down here checking on me, constantly checking on me. And then they would do things like, we noticed you came in a car. I had an old beat-up car with no brakes. That was a lot of fun. Use emergency brake, and I said I tried reverse once. That doesn't work too well. 60 miles an hour, you know, you leave your hat in the back seat. If you have see, here's it's a drop. It's a drop. We're at we had names and numbers like the rest of us had. We didn't have cell phones and all that stuff. But if Bob didn't show up, we'd say Bob works. He's okay. Stay where you work. Bob works at T.G. Lee. We know he's out in the yard around this time. Let's all go down and see how Bob's doing. Hey, Bob, how you doing? You say, hey, guys, good to see you. And he said, well, Jerry, you know, Friday night, he likes to go to the meeting, but he's working at Barron's Men's Store selling men's clothing. He says, Buddy K came down and knocked, just knocked on the window and went like that. You know how much that meant to me, to have somebody care about me that much, to come down here and know when I couldn't get to a meeting? The whole emphasis when I came into the program was on Chapter 7, intensive care with another alcoholic. Intensive work with another alcoholic. We had so many wet drunks. I've been in meetings with guys that pull out a bottle and drink right in the middle of the meeting. They made him put it away. They didn't throw him out, though. Try that in a church sometime. They did not throw him out. They just said, put that away, cool it, you know. It was constant work. And I think I started to develop. He said, if you came in a car and it was empty, somebody would say, I didn't see anybody in your car. No, I didn't bring. From here on out, you're picking Joe up every night. And they gave me Joe. He was a toll gate keeper down on the beach at Hollywood. He drove me crazy. He never shut up for a minute. And he had a monotone voice. And it was like, wah, 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 wah. And he had a basset hound that looked more like his owner. Big floppy ears and strolling. He always greeted, you know, and he was like that. But Joe kept me sober. You know, I'm going to tell you something. Sometimes it almost sounds like a heresy. We didn't get into the steps, folks. I'm sorry. I hate to break anybody's bubble, especially anybody that's really orthodox. We had a guy named Vance. It was like kicking him in the ankle and he'd go, if he had a question about the big book, is that right, Vance? Is that Payson? And then bang, he would go back to this, you know. That was what the exposure I had. We had a few seminars, but very few. We had mostly closed meetings, But we did go once in a while to a meeting like this, and the speaker meeting. But they kept me tight to the group. They said, you're not ready yet. We'll tell you when. That was the whole point with me. They told me what to do, when to do it, how to do it. And they emphasized, he says, a job is just something you do between meetings. You don't get caught up in all this. You just go work and be, you know, whatever you are. About 3 months into that again, here we go. Mr. Bigshot was offered a job in North Miami Beach as a general manager for a company. My sponsor told me later, he says, I wanted to tell you not to take the job. But he says, I didn't. You were so enthusiastic. It was a total and absolute nightmare. The company completely gutted the whole place, took our trucks, pulled all the wires out of the phones, and left back and went back up to Georgia and left me holding a bag for 65 employees with no money. And that I thought I was going to get lynched. I mean, they were really mad. They thought I had something to do with it, which I didn't. So I don't even know what happened after that. Sandy and I had gotten back together through the program, which I hate to bust anybody's bubble. It's a big mistake. Big mistake. Too much too soon. And unfortunately, it didn't work out. And but I came back to Orlando, and I'm still on what happened. I'm in Orlando, and the police department was looking for a counselor that had a couple of years of sobriety. And I went in there. The public safety division was attached to the Orlando Police Department, and they ran a halfway house on the second floor of the Salvation Army. And they gave you a book of client folders and everything, and you know that. Then from that, I went to The Door Task, which is now Center for the Drug-Free Living, and they gave me a jail cell 6F with 16 people in there trying to stay sober, and they did mix some drug addicts. They said, we don't care about all that. We need the space, and we're going to put drug addicts in your cell whether you like it or not, and you know, and all that stuff. I said, whatever, you know, I'm getting paid, and that's it. It was a grant out of Washington, D.C. to a treatment alternative to street crime called TASC. Got involved with some gal again, you know, and blew that job. But I was sober now. Point. My character defects carried over from my sobriety, from my drunkenness to my sobriety. You know, some of times you get the idea that, well, if you come in here, you're going to get washed whiter than snow, and everything that's wrong with you is just going to suddenly disappear. You know, some of the character defects that I have will probably die 10 minutes after I do. And I'm grossly aware of them. Really, I am. And I won't go into no detail on that one either. But I have to be very, very careful. That's what happened. Whew, I'm going pretty good on time, aren't I? Now I guess I'm at the point where it's what it's like now. I'm going to make a shocking statement. I have had more aggravation sober than I ever had when I was drunk. And the reason for that was I was drunk and didn't care. I worked for a guy who did some time. I won't mention his name, but he was a great guy. God bless him. He's Mr. Positive Thinker. If I mention his name, you know him immediately. But I'm going to do that. He came home one night, his wife's sitting in the middle of a bare house. Carpet's gone, refrigerator's gone, furniture's gone, everything's gone. And he says, what's the matter, honey? She says, they took everything. They took the refrigerator. They even picked up the carpet and the TV and everything. He says, good, that's just one more payment we don't have to make. And that was the type of attitude he had. And I, being drunk, I mean, so take back man, don't snap my sheen. They say that in Georgia. The take back man is the repossessor. They call it snap the sheen. I even made a song of take back man, don't snap my sheen. Do that. It didn't go very far. They put it on a 13-inch disc, and it was only a 12-inch record. But anyway, what it's like now. Well, I go to a lot of meetings because I was told that meeting makers make it. Now, I've had some flack over that just recently. You know, well, there's more to this program than that, you know. Well, this program is about not drinking alcohol. That's what I was told. It's not about get this and get that and, big, you know, big job and get something going for you and all that. Those things can happen. We have the promises, you know, and some of them do happen, sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly. But things aren't all rosebud, you know. So what I have to remember is, when the yogurt gets deep, and my Jack Daniels monkey that's sitting right here on my shoulder saying, I know what's going to straighten you out. Come on. come on over here, a couple of me, and you'll be, and then the thinking's still there. I'd like to tell you, the compulsion is gone. The compulsion is gone. But from time to time, sometimes people go, ooh, 36 years. I do think of the old, I think back in those band days when we were just raising hell and having more fun and getting drunk and just making money and doing all these people clapping and everybody following you around all over the place. There was a lot of fun there. I was listening to a commercial, the jazz station, 89.9, where some band is playing at Waldorf Astoria. Well, those are the kind of places we used to play. I didn't play the Waldorf, but similar. And they were from 8:30 to 1. I thought, boy, those are my hours. That's what I love. And I'm going, you flaky, you're still crazy. After 36 years, you're still thinking like that. You take a shot of Jack Daniels to be on the floor. And even Gail, with her CPR training, couldn't revive you because you couldn't handle it. And I know that. They got me against the wall and said, you cannot drink alcohol today. They emphasized today. That's another thing. I caught some flack not long ago because I believe this is a day-to-day program. And this particular person waves the banner and says, you can never, ever drink alcohol again. He means safely, without fail, because every time I did drink, I was always in trouble. It always gave me trouble. So I understand what that means today. I can't drink one day at a time. And I keep that. And how do I do that? They're on the wall. I pray. I didn't get into the religion. I am a minister. Don't everybody run out of the door. I'm not going to have an altar call. You know. Although that might not. No, I'm kidding. I didn't even get into that because some people, oh my God, we're going to listen to this again. You know. Oh, turn your hymnals to page 299. But anyway. I forgot what the hell I was going to say. The nice thing about talking to a group like this and not a church group is you can be honest with them and they understand that we're flaky and we forget things from time to time. So I do what I can do and I work the program. I pray every night, every day I pray a very simple prayer and it goes like this. Dear God, help me this day not to take a drink of alcohol. And if I can help another drunk or anyone else for that matter and it be your will, so be it. At night, I take my 10th step. Sometimes I find it hard to dig up enough stuff that I've really done bad, so I must have done something bad. It's kind of like the kid going to confession for his first time. He says, Father, I don't know what I've done anything wrong. Just make a general confession. Get out of here. I have to say, God, if I did anything to make you mad today, I'm sorry. And other days, I did some things I shouldn't have done, and I get that into my 10th step. And I do add, thank you, God, today for keeping me sober. I've got to do that. They said a grateful drunk does not get drunk. I believe that. I have to hear more gratitude, more gratitude, more gratitude. Because even though my pocket's full and empty today compared to what I had many years ago, I'm sober today. I've got another, don't ask me how many, wife now, and she's a dirt, does not understand alcohol, doesn't understand any about me at all, cannot figure out how we ever got together. But we love each other dearly. We are as different as day and night. She doesn't know anything about this business or about my craziness, but she's a wonderful lady. Our cross to bear is we're taking care of her 92-year-old mother, which also is a real patience tolerance thing. If you ever have one of those in your house, God bless her. She's a sweetheart. We love her, but she takes up an awful lot of our time. And she's not around the bend completely yet, but she might be heading that way. So we do what we can. And that's what I'm telling you tonight. The only message I have tonight is, one, for God's sake, no matter what, don't drink today. If you feel like you're going to drink, say, I might drink tomorrow. I used to have a guy stand up and say, I guarantee you I will not take a drink today, but I wouldn't bet you one penny that I won't drink tomorrow. And I used to go, boy, that's strange. No, it's not. It's keeping the memory green. Mike down in Fort Lauderdale at the Chamber of Commerce, rather in Miami, a meeting on Sunday, he used to say, you got to keep the memory green, because when you're green, you're ripe. When you're green, you're ripe. No, that's not the way you put it. See what happened again? Why didn't you remind me? Did you know I was going to say that? It's something about a banana growing and ripening. And I don't know what it is either, and I'm glad I'm not getting paid for doing this, because I would never be asked to come back again. All I know is, folks, I love you. Don't drink. Go to meetings and have a good life. Bye.